Absolutely intercultural.
Fullständig tvärkulturell.
Absolut interkulturell.
Absolutamente intercultural.
Absolutely intercultural.
Good day and a big welcome to show 99 of Absolutely Intercultural, which comes to you from down under, straight from the Sunshine Coast in Australia. For those of you who worried with me after show 97, as you can hear, I did receive my visa as a visiting academic just in time. In fact, only 15 minutes before the embassy in Berlin closed on the Friday before I left. So now I'm at the University of the Sunshine Coast in Queensland and trying to survive the heat. Oh yes, and happy Christmas to everyone. To be honest, it feels strange to celebrate Christmas in summer. Back home, normally we have temperatures below zero and often even a bit of snow. But this year, I've done my Christmas shopping in shops where air conditioning from morning to evening is absolutely essential, even if from the loudspeakers we are listening to Winter Wonderland and I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas. In our first category, Absolutely Down Under, I asked students and lecturers at the University of the Sunshine Coast how to celebrate Christmas in the heat.
The heat? 32, 35, 37 degrees, all you want to do is swim and have salad.
In our second category, Absolutely Experiential, I interviewed John Kedler from Brock University in Canada, and he told me why he and his students travel to Africa for intercultural excursions. He explains why his students should not only learn from their teachers, but also through experiential learning, which happens when they work together with ordinary people in Africa.
And it just so happens that the professors that they will be studying under in Namibia and Botswana will be 4 years old or maybe 80 years old okay. And maybe illiterate. Mm-hmm. But I can guarantee you that they will speak 3, 4, or 5 languages.
In our third and last category, Absolutely Prepared, I asked Ariane, an intercultural trainer and teacher, what students can do to prepare themselves interculturally for their experiences abroad.
People have to be prepared and know more about the country they're going to, but basically it's a personal experience, and they have also to think about what they are personally, where they come from, and what kind of company they will work with.
Now let us start with the show, and let me give you some seasonal intercultural expressions I gathered down under. Just like in Europe, Christmas plays a rather important role in the Australian calendar, and most people have a longish holiday, and many people will travel in order to be closer to the sea. However, while in Europe the associations you would expect in the context of Christmas celebrations would be snow, fireplace, spicy cakes, and mulled wine, the Australians would mention words like beach, air conditioning, seafood, and drinks by the pool, which of course makes for a completely different and much more tropical Christmas experience. As I did not know how to plan my own Christmas here, I asked around at the university what Australians do on Christmas Day. In our first category, Absolutely Down Under, I found out that Australian Christmas is all about coping with the extreme heat, and yet the advertisements in magazines and on television often use the metaphor of snow, which is a paradox that Australians, however, seem to have accepted.
What we do is we all get together and have lots of parties. It's the festive season and everyone just likes to have their friends over and lots of drinks and...
Lots and lots of drinks.
On Christmas Day, we go to the beach first thing in the morning and then just have fruit for breakfast.
All the stone and fruits are out in season,
yeah.
So everyone has mangoes and peaches and things on Christmas Day.
So it's a lot about eating and going to the beach. Now, the traditional Christmas idea is much more about snow and jingle bells and everything. Is that weird for you when you see these pictures on television?
Yeah, it is, because all the pictures do include snow, and Santa, as the main thing for the kids, is dressed up in a snowsuit. And our Santa here dresses up in the exact same way. So you see a Santa and he's sweating all over the place. And so they always tend to drink a lot of beer. Our Santa's in Australia.
Yeah, Santa does drink beer.
So how do you explain this to the children, that you get these pictures of the cold and snow?
Santa's from the North Pole, so that's why he dresses up.
And he's got to go all around. Christmas. He's got to go all around the world, so he's got to be prepared for every bit of weather.
So he's just badly dressed for this part of the world.
I'm originally from New Zealand, so it's not as hot as here. We went from having hot dinners to having salads with cold hams going from New Zealand to here, but that's the only difference we've noticed.
Is that because the hot meals seem inappropriate?
Definitely. It's just you're cooking in a hot kitchen, which heats the house. But if you have something cold, it doesn't heat you up so much. So
Everyone commutes to a house with a pool on Christmas Day.
Yeah. Or you buy a paddling pool. Buy a kid's paddling pool and you just all sit in the paddling pool over Christmas break. Yeah.
Because it gets up to about 40 degrees Celsius on Christmas Day.
So what are your personal plans for this Christmas then?
I'm going to the beach. And then with some family friends, my mum and dad, and then we're going back to those family friends' place for lunch, sit under a fan and just have a few drinks and fruit.
Salads and fruit. We always have prawns on Christmas too. That's a bit of an Australian tradition. Everyone gets prawns and hams instead of roast turkeys and that sort of thing that you see on TV.
And I guess I'll be spending Christmas Eve at my mum's house, and then we'll all wake up in the morning, open up our presents, and then eat and eat and eat.
We have chicken, we have roast vegetables, we have normal vegetables in cheese sauce, and then we usually have like a lamb and a mint sauce.
We have all the cold meats, the chicken, ham, turkey, and then someone brings prawns and someone brings salads and baked potatoes, and then we have caramel tart.
I'll be having lots of seafood and mince pies.
We'll be having a cold Christmas lunch with turkey and ham and lots of salad and lots of lovely fresh fruit.
I'm going to be eating prawns on the barbecue and a salad because it'll be too hot to think of anything else.
We do a dinner, which starts at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We spend the afternoon in the pool if someone has a pool.
Christmas is very much a family get-together when everyone gathers from wherever they are just to spend a day to just being together, really, because it's such a hot, hot day.
It doesn't have the same feeling here in Australia as in Europe, because you can't get excited about the heat. 32, 35, 37 degrees, all you want to do is swim and have salad.
I have to say that because I grew up in the UK, it never feels like Christmas in Australia because it's really hot. And so I don't really celebrate Christmas, I just celebrate a week off work.
We spend most of the time in the swimming pool and we try not to wear party hats because all the colours run down our faces.
We love the heat though. That's kind of the best part of the day that we get to spend in the pool. And Christmas with snowmen and that, it's just desensitised to us. We don't really think about that at all. We just think about the pool and barbecue and everyone around.
And sitting on the balcony with the sea breeze.
Yeah.
Having drinks. That's basically what it's all about.
I used to feel the same way until I went to live in Canada for several years, where, of course, every year was a white Christmas, which was fantastic. You could have a fire and the turkey just seemed to taste better and there was snow outside. It was just fantastic. Now, coming back to live in Australia, it seems a little odd. I miss the snow and the cold weather and the fires and, just not the same. Still fun, but not the same.
And we don't bestel here. People don't make decorations and do the whole traditional thing and have all the build-up and the singing. And people don't go around caroling very much, do they?
Yeah, so I have the Australian Christmas celebration, which is with all the family, and they bring that. And because my son's half Nigerian, we go to a Nigerian Christmas party, which is like all the black kids, and I'm usually one of the only white people there. And we get one of the men dresses up as Santa, so it's good because the kids get to differentiate between the generic white Santa Claus and they get to see a black Santa Claus. And we eat all the traditional Nigerian food. You pay about $20 and you get to have, like, you know, all the curry and all of the, like, pepper soups and all those kind of things, which is absolutely fantastic. And all the kids get to play together and it's a very cultural thing, so that's nice.
So while there seems to be a typical Australian Christmas with seafood barbecue, salads and drinks by the swimming pool, of course different national groups also keep their own traditions in Australia, and Cassie told us about the Nigerian Christmas party with wonderful African food where Father Christmas is impersonated by a black Nigerian, which seems a wonderful opportunity for children and adults to be reminded of cultural diversity. In our second category, absolutely experiential, we see what Canadian students can learn from ordinary Africans if they have the right attitude to learning and to their guest country. I asked John, a colleague from our partner university in Canada, why he takes students out of their regular surroundings and organizes intercultural excursions to Namibia, Botswana, and South Africa.
Our university as mandate is education, and one aspect of that education is internationalization. And the majority of the internationalization that is being practiced at the university is through professors and lectures. But we also want to internationalize our students by taking them out of Canada to another country. So we have projects in Peru, Ecuador, Brazil, and I've just 4 years ago developed a program in Namibia, and I'm now developing a program in Botswana where we take students for 3 weeks of experiential learning. So they're working with the people and learning from the people.
Experiential learning. So you're putting the learner in the center and you're trying to make their learning a little more autonomous. Can you zoom in a little bit and tell us what actually happens when you're taking your students, let's say, to Botswana or to Namibia?
The first thing is that we want to make sure that we're taking the right type of student to these countries. And that, in a sense, unfortunately, means that we have to unlearn certain things. Mm-hmm. And if I gave you a word association and I said Africa, your first reaction might be AIDS, malaria, civil war, child soldiers, blood diamonds, things like that. And those are there in certain parts of Africa, but Africa is not a country, it's a continent, and there's so much more to Africa. And what we want to do with our experiential learning program is to actually bring students there and to show them the real Africa, or at least the part that we're in. And so I explained to my students that they have to go there with humility, not with a sense of missionary zeal or neocolonialism. When they go into a lecture in Brock University, they are not going in there to teach the professor something. Mm-hmm. They're going there with humility, knowing that the professor has a PhD, that the mm-hmm. professor has done research, and so they're going there to learn. The students that I take to Namibia or Botswana or the other countries, they are going there to learn. They're not the experts, and I tell them that they have to be just as respectful of their professors as they are of our professors at Brock. And it just so happens that the professors that they will be studying under in Namibia and Botswana will be 4 years old, or maybe 80 years old, okay. and maybe illiterate. Mm-hmm. But I can guarantee you that they will speak 3, 4, or 5 languages. And you're not going to teach them anything about Botswana or Namibia. They are going to teach you about it. And the way they're going to teach it is not through lecture, but by working together. So we're on building projects. We renovate preschools in Botswana. We're going to be working at a cheetah conservation area, working for the Botswana Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, mm-hmm. Working at a school specifically for young women who, for one reason or another, are not in the general school system. There's a very high incidence of AIDS in the country. And so we're going to be working together, not for them or to them or at them, but we're going to be working with them.
It seems to make absolute sense that if students approach a foreign country with humility and the wish to learn, they will probably get more learning out of their intercultural experience than if they followed a seminar about that country. So we understand that intercultural learning could be initiated by lecturers at the home university. It could be triggered by contact with people in the country that is visited. But our last guests on this show stresses that the ultimate responsibility for this learning is on us, the learners and travelers, and that the experience should always be accompanied by thorough reflection. In our last category, absolutely prepared, Ariane explains that we need to understand our own values and backgrounds in order to be open to learn from the others.
I think it's, of course, one part. People have to be prepared and know more about the country they're going to, but basically it's a personal experience, and they have also to think about what they are personally, where they come from, and what kind of company they will work with.
Can you give us an example? I mean, well, what can we do with the students to make them think about where they come from, where they're going, their own identity maybe?
Sometimes when I do trainings, people think that they will learn things about other cultures. They think, okay, I'm going to Finland, I will learn things about Finland. And they will learn things about Finland, how the culture works there. But they it's not a big help if they know how Finland works, if they don't know how they work themselves. So we will really kind of push them to think back about sometimes where they come from, what their education is, what the history and geography of their own country is, so that they understand better how they personally tick. And where there might be differences, but also similarities with the country they will be going to.
Right. How does that help them? So I can see your students in the classes, they think more about their own identity, about their cultural identity, their national background, maybe even class backgrounds and things like that. And why do they need that to be more adaptable to the new culture?
Because every culture has other needs.
So what is your aim when you have done a seminar?
The aim is to make them understand that the culture they come from is influencing the perception they have of the world, and that they will travel to another culture bringing their own culture along with them. But you might not be aware before that they will deal with many different perceptions, and that there is not only one perception of the world. So I think it's really to prepare the people about diversity, what exists out there, and that their way of doing things might not be the only way.
Reflection seems to be something very crucial, because the intercultural experience, we get more and more of our students go out. What tools do you use to encourage students to reflect about what they live when they are abroad?
There are different intercultural tools which kind of really push the people to sit down and to reflect about a situation, saying, okay, that's what happened to me. What is my perspective? What is the other person's perspective? I must admit that usually when I offer these kind of debriefing sessions to people coming home from another country, they do not consider that it's important. They say, oh, we had a good time, or we had no good time, but they don't go beyond this reflection. So we really have actually to work with concrete examples they bring, or, you know, at the beginning they don't have any to share. They said, no, everything was normal. Then we start to look at examples and stories and concrete experiences, and start to kind of look at the underlining assumption on both sides. So it's to say, we act based on certain values, and if there are misunderstandings between two persons, basically there are misunderstandings in terms of values. And so it needs time. I mean, out of my experience, to do something like that, the debriefing work, it needs at least 2 days. It's beginning to kind of warm up to people, then realizing that they have a whole lot of inexperience they can study, and then really taking concrete examples from their side and putting it in direct relationship to intercultural theory. So competence is matching actually experience with the theory. That out of this you will be able to make competence out of it.
Now, at this conference, often when I hear about intercultural challenges, people take examples of Japan and China. Do you think that the further the culture is away from our own culture, the more difficult it gets?
No, I think the further you get away, the more tolerant you are to difference. I mean, we know that the Chinese are thinking differently, and so it's there is maybe even an exotic element about it. Whereas if you go from Switzerland to Germany, you think that you share the same language and therefore the same culture. And usually, these are actually experiences which are sometimes more painful, because small differences are really making actually the big blow.
So let us not underestimate the small cultural differences, because they may be the origin of many intercultural misunderstandings. I liked Ariane's equation that intercultural competence is a result of an analysis of the personal experiences, but only on the background of theoretical knowledge. Now, I'm afraid that this truth brings us to the end of the show today, and also to the end of this year. But what about you people out there who are interested in intercultural communication? What are your intercultural New Year's resolutions? Want to make more international experiences? Want to spend more time critically reflecting the ones that you've already made? Let us know what your plans are for the next year. You can share your thoughts at absolutely-intercultural.com. This was the last show for the year 2009, and I hope you enjoy the festive season, be it in the cold or, like me, in the heat. The team of Absolutely Intercultural wishes you the best for the year 2010. And don't miss our next show. Believe it or not, this will be show number 100, and it will be coming to you from Anne Fox in Denmark on the 8th of January 2010. Until then, bleiben Sie absolut interkulturell.
Absolutely intercultural.
Vollständig interkulturell.
Absolut interkulturalisch.
Absolutamente intercultural.
Absolutely intercultural.